If you're enjoying this podcast, please consider leaving a rating or review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. It really helps me out a lot. Cheers.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hi, I'm Jed Hearn, author of Fires of Jed, and this is The Novel Analyst Show. Today we're going to be talking about openings. How can you hook readers in the beginning of your book to make sure they stick around for the rest? And to help me in this discussion, I'm going to be talking about The Ember Blade by Chris Wooding, which is a massive, big, fat fantasy book out of 824 pages in my edition. Yet it has such a great, compelling beginning that I knew right away after the first 48 pages that I was going to read the whole thing. So, what is The Ember Blade about? It is a story about a group of misfits who come together to stage a heist to steal this legendary sword, the Ember Blade from the title, in order to strike back at the oppressors who control their country and hopefully become a freedom, a symbol for freedom for their people. Got my words confused a little bit there. So, in this episode, I'm going to look at the first 8 chapters of the book, the first 48 pages of the book, that is, and analyze them to try to figure out the answer to the following question. What did Chris Wooding do in these first 48 pages that made me know I was in the hands of a master storyteller? Because as we both know, if you don't have a compelling beginning, readers aren't going to stick around for the middle, and they're not going to reach your awesome ending. So it's really important to have a beginning that does a couple of very important functions, which I will discuss in today's episode. There is going to be spoilers for The Ember Blade, but only for the first 8 chapters. So if you don't mind having the very beginning of the book spoiled for you, then go ahead and keep watching or listening. If you would prefer to read the thing without being spoiled, go ahead and do that and then come back to this later. So before I get into analyzing these 8 chapters, I should point out something really quickly with a kind of general note about these chapters, which is that there isn't anything massively flashy about these opening chapters. There's no huge twist, there's no big action set pieces, there's nothing that is trying to show how clever the author is. Rather, Chris Wooding demonstrates a very subtle, confident storytelling style by the way that characters are developed in these opening chapters, by the way that questions are asked, and by the way that you as the reader are made curious about where the plot is going to head from here. So, let's dive into the chapters from the opening of The Ember Blade. So, chapter 1 opens with what I think is a very fantastic and compelling piece of dialogue, which goes like this. Quote, "Keep faith and hold fast, and we will free our land." End quote. With these words, the first chapter starts in medias res, following these two Ossian revolutionaries who have just escaped from an attempted revolt and are being hunted by these demonic creatures called the Dread Knights. Doesn't that just sound scary? What this chapter does really well is that it sets up the main conflict of the book, which is this conflict between the Ossians, who are the subjugated peoples of this country, and the Croydons, who are this kind of foreign power who came in and conquered the country 30 years ago and have started imposing their laws and their beliefs and everything on the land. And the story is very much about a group of plucky Ossians fighting back against the Croydons. And right on the first page of this chapter, we are immediately positioned to sympathize with the Ossians because the Croydons have, like I mentioned before, these almost demonic creatures who are hunting them. For me, the paragraph that made me sympathize with the two Ossian characters who you're following in this first chapter went like this. Quote, "The forest whipped and scratched him as he clambered up a muddy slope, breath burning his lungs and a cold fist of terror in his gut." Just one simple sentence, but it just immediately captures the feeling and the emotional experience of fleeing from a superior, scarier force. And for doing that, it is very successful in making us sympathize with the characters in this first chapter. And I think that's something important to note, is that this is a great way that you can create sympathy for characters in your own stories, is if you show them going through some sort of difficult struggle where they are the underdog, we just like underdogs. Because we aren't going to barrack for someone who is beating up a person who is half their weight, but we are probably more likely to barrack for that underdog boxer who is clearly outmatched, who is clearly outreached. They're just a more interesting and compelling person to, you know, root for. And that's what we see done really well in this opening chapter. By the end of this chapter, readers are left with a very clear question in their minds. And that question is this. Will Ossia be freed from the cruelty of the Crotons? What this is doing is it's really setting up the kind of meta conflict of the whole book. The book is, yes, about a group of, you know, ragtag thieves, criminals, orphans, basically trying to escape from these dread knights. But it also is more about this whole countrywide struggle of a nation attempting to free itself from the yoke of external control. So this first chapter serves as the story in miniature. It's almost taking everything that happens in the next 824 pages and condensing it into kind of a small little diorama that allows you to instinctively expect what will happen next. So when I mentioned that idea of the chapter asking you a question, it's not just any kind of question, it's a dramatic question. It's a question that you are, that the author, rather, is putting into the reader's mind as something that is central to what the story's plot will be about. And this is what the opening of a book has to be about for me. It has to be about dramatic questions. What are the stakes of the story? What is the plot that I can expect moving forward? What is the main issue that the characters are grappling with? That's contained in the dramatic questions you ask within the first, say, 48 pages of your book. Chapter 2. So this is where we get introduced to the main characters, Aaron and Cade. Aaron is an Ossian, kind of like fairly high status person who wants to be a Croton, basically. He absolutely worships everything they do. He totally believes all of the things they believe. And, you know, he just really wants to be accepted by them. Cade, on the other hand, is a slightly lower status person who is being pressured into becoming a carpenter by his father. He is going along with the fact that the country is controlled by Crotons, because to not go along with that would be treasonous and you would probably get hung. But he's not exactly buying into it as much as Aaron. So in this chapter, we have these two characters hunting for what they think is this really dangerous, mythical beast. But in reality, it's just like a very common creature that they have exaggerated in their minds to be significantly more deadly. So they basically go into a cave, they try to get it, but it escapes, and then they wearily trudge out. But what we see in this chapter is a lot of important character-building information about Cade and Aaron. So, for instance, if we look at the closing lines of this chapter, it goes like this. "You give up too easily," Aaron said over his shoulder as he started to trudge up the ravine. "Aye, and you don't give up at all." So that second bit of dialogue was from Cade. And what we see here is the perfect encapsulation of both of their characters, in a sense. Aaron is defined by a ridiculous sense of determination and grit, which can be just as destructive as it is helpful in getting what he desires. And Cade, on the other hand, is someone who prefers to tell stories rather than get into conflicts and stories himself. In addition to this whole idea of setting up some of the key values of these characters, this chapter does something really interesting as well. It shows a friendship. One of the most underrated techniques to create sympathy for your characters in your book, at least in my opinion, is to show your characters interacting with other people on a friendly basis. Because if you think about it, if your character is interesting enough or proactive enough or likable enough to have a friend inside the world of the story, then they're probably interesting enough or proactive enough or likable enough for readers to enjoy spending time with them. So by showing your main character interacting with friends or, you know, just other significant people in their life on a kind of like positive basis, it's subtly inferring to readers that, hey, this is somebody who you will probably enjoy spending time with. Now, that doesn't mean that you have to like give your evil inquisitor type person friends in the first chapter to make readers feel sympathetic for them. But it is one technique that you can consider with characters who you feel like it is a plausible part of their world. If you give them a friendship and you dramatize that early in your book, it's going to hopefully make readers be endeared to that character as well. So the main dramatic question that is left in readers' minds after reading this chapter is the following. Will Aaron's relentless determination get him into trouble? Hint, it probably will, but I won't spoil what happens after the next 48 pages. Chapter 3. So here we have Aaron attempting to teach Cade how to sword fight, but Cade is way more interested in just telling stories. Again, demonstrating some key differences and possible points of tension and conflict between their characters. What we see here is a really interesting world-building technique, which is one I love to see in action and one that I love using in my own stories. And this is the idea of having stories within your story that help to characterize people and the world and various other things in your book. So to quote from chapter 3 in here, quote, Aaron, on the other hand, loved anything Croden and said the old Ossian folk tales were for bumpkins. To get around the problem, Cade changed the names in his mother's tales and passed them off as Croden. He suspected Aaron knew, but the deception let him enjoy the stories of his homeland without admitting it to himself. So again, Aaron and Cade are both Ossian, but Aaron sort of like worships the Crotons and wants to be accepted by them. He thinks they are a superior civilization. So what we see in this bit of world building is not only are we actually dramatizing some of the stories about the world, which I haven't read out, but that's earlier in the chapter. And what that does is that kind of gives you an idea about sort of how people believe myth in this world, what kind of myths they believe, and also what those myths say about themselves. But also we see the inklings of contradiction within Aaron, the main character. We see that despite his love for Croden society and despite his overwhelming desire to be accepted into their culture, he still kind of has a bit of a soft spot for his, you know, proper ancestors, I said in inverted commas, the Ossians. As Robert McKee says in Story, which is right here, where is the quote? It's not going to be on the back of the book. He says that true dimension is created through contradiction. So basically, when you have characters that have contradictory desires or contradictory values, it creates intrigue because readers want to know what is the cause for you behaving in one way in one situation versus behaving in a completely different way in a different situation. So the key dramatic question that we're left with through this chapter is, will Aaron's love for all things Croden create a wedge between him and Cade? Because we already see the hint of this in the fact that Cade is having to disguise his stories. But will it create conflict in the future? Readers are intrigued. Chapter 4 follows Aaron attempting to drag Cade along to a Croden church. We see here a very interesting example of one of my other favourite world-building techniques, exposition as ammunition. So what that basically means is that if you're just trying to give information to readers, just because you need to give information to readers, it's probably going to fall a little bit flat. If, on the other hand, you can use your exposition, that is, details about your world and so on, and you can make the characters use that exposition in a way to get what they want in dialogue, it can be very effective. So what we are wondering as readers at this point in the story is, what exactly are the differences between Crotons and Ossians? And this bit of dialogue in the chapter between Aaron and Cade dramatizes this fact. So we have Cade essentially saying that, oh, you know, things were like a bit better before Crotons were here. We could carry our swords around without needing a permit. And Aaron is like, are you kidding? Like, it was a lawless land before they came. And, you know, there was like tons of bandits everywhere. It's so much better that they've brought their law and order to our society. And neither of them were alive when Crotons weren't in the land. So they've only known Croden occupation. So this kind of also reflects the ways that they were raised and the people whose opinions influenced their own. We also see a clear definition of Aaron's goal in this chapter. And that goal, as I have hinted at before, is to be fully accepted as a Croden, even though he has Ossian ancestry. So this is another really important thing the opening chapters have to do. They have to not only make readers ask questions, that is, create suspense about the plot, but they also have to show to readers why they should care about these characters. And the quickest way to make readers care about a character, in my experience, is to give the character goals. Something that they are striving for, something that they desire. Whether it's good or bad, it creates intrigue within readers because they already want to know, or they automatically want to know, rather, will the character achieve this goal? What will the pursuit of this goal do to the character? And so on. So at the end of this chapter, we also have something that sets up a little bit of a longer arc within the story, which is important now that we're getting more into the meat of it, where Aaron is attacked by the older brothers of this Croton girl that he's trying to court. And they're basically like, you're Ossian, stay away from her, go find an Ossian girl instead. And he is like really angry, but he's like too scared to fight back against them because they're much bigger than him. So we are left with another key dramatic question, which is, will Aaron's Ossian ancestry prevent him from being with his love interest? And I think this is interesting as well, because it's starting to set up, as I mentioned before, a slightly longer arc. So some of the stuff that's happened in the previous chapters has almost felt like those chapters have been a bit of a short story, like they have just been a self-contained, interesting piece of narrative on themselves. But now we're starting to set up some slightly longer arcs, which is important to do, because if you are just constantly serving readers with short story after short story, with no real interlinking between the chapters, they're going to wonder if there is actually some cohesion and overall arc to your story as a whole. Chapter 5 doesn't have Aaron in it at all. It's all about Cade having dinner with his mother and his father, and his parents are sort of disapproving of his friendship with Cade. His parents are disapproving of Cade's friendship with Aaron, because they're like, you know, Aaron is like way into Crotons. That's kind of disturbing for an Ossian person. His father even says directly to Cade, quote, that boy's a Croton lover, and he's the son of a Croton lover, Baal said darkly. Mixing with his sort will only bring you trouble. Heed that, boy. And Cade just flat out disagrees, because he has too much loyalty and respect for his friend to ever think that Aaron's love of all things Croton will create conflict between them or just issues in general. And we see a really interesting thing about Cade in this chapter. We see that he is unfailingly loyal, which will grow to become arguably his most important character trait moving forward. So we can already see that within the first 5 chapters, we have been introduced to the main character and his kind of sidekick slash secondary main character. And we have both seen a very clear dramatization of their goals. So Aaron's goal is to become accepted as a Croton, and then Cade's goal is very much to like strengthen his friendship with Aaron and to just be a loyal supporter for what he does. While I don't think Chapter 5 does this to a massive extent, which is, you know, maybe something that could have been modified, not that I'm telling Chris Wooding how to write an already excellent book any differently than he has, but as Robert McKee says in Story, true character is revealed in the decisions that we make under pressure. The greater the pressure, the greater trueness of a character is revealed. So like, in a situation where it's just dinner with your parents like this, Cade is under limited pressure to reveal true character. So what comes out is probably less true to him, as opposed to if he was like getting his hand cut off or tortured or whatever, and they were like, tell us where Aaron is hiding. And if in that instance he refused to say where Aaron was, there's more pressure there. So it's more of a demonstration of his true loyalty and his true nature. Just to provide a random example, that doesn't necessarily happen in the rest of the book. So the dramatic question we're left with after Chapter 5 is, will Cade's loyalty to Aaron remain strong and true? In Chapter 6, we show Aaron playing a game of castles with a Croton shooter. Castles is pretty much chess. What we see here is a beautiful case of both plot and thematic foreshadowing. So in the game of castles, Aaron is pretending to be weaker than he actually is. He's thrown a couple of previous games, he's sacrificed a few of his pieces in this game, and as a result, he is able to pull off an unlikely-looking victory from the jaws of defeat. This is referencing the very nature of the heist genre which the story belongs to. If you think about what a heist is, it's essentially a group of weaker individuals band together and use their wits to overcome a much stronger foe, often using some sort of twist at the end to succeed. So if you think about a lot of great heist movies, they normally do this, right? You get to the end, you think the main characters have lost, and it turns out they've got one more twist in their pocket, and it lets them win. There's also a really good quote within this chapter, which becomes a kind of arc word within the story. And by arc word, I mean a phrase that is consistently repeated, often with more nuanced layers of meaning each time, which is, as an aside, one of my favorite techniques. And the arc word is, the arc phrase, rather, is, there is no victory without sacrifice. That's just telling you what the story is about. It's telling you that you can expect that the characters are going to have to sacrifice things to get what they want, to achieve their goals. People are going to have to die. They're going to have to throw away old relationships. They're going to have to sacrifice even their old values in order to achieve their primary goal of freeing Ossia from Croton rule. And this is just beautiful that this chapter acts as this ecosystem, this micro reflection of what the whole story is about. The author is telling us what the story is going to contain, but it's doing so in a way that doesn't spoil the beauty of the story as you're exploring it. The way I like to think about it is that it's telling you what kind of things you can expect to feel, but it's not necessarily telling you what you can expect to happen plot-wise. So you kind of get this sense that, oh, I really enjoyed that feeling of Aaron pulling off an unlikely victory from the jaws of defeat. Oh, that's what's going to happen throughout this whole book. Okay, I'm excited, I'm in. On the subject of arc words, there's also another important arc phrase within this chapter, which is, to defeat your enemy, you must first understand him. So again, arc words are kind of these phrases that are repeated throughout the book, often forming some sort of thematic motif. You can think about the whole with great power comes great responsibility thing from Spider-Man as an example of arc words here. And your first 50 or 48 pages in this case is a great time to establish the key arc words that you want to use throughout your book. So the dramatic question at the end of this chapter is prefaced by Aaron's father arriving back from this kind of long trip he was just on. And the dramatic question is pretty simple. It's what kind of person will Aaron's father be? And that carries us on into the next chapter, which sometimes is all that your dramatic question has to do in these opening chapters. Sure, it's great to have some that set up your story as a whole, but it's also important to remember that each of your opening chapters has to make readers go on to the next. In chapter 7, Aaron's father returns and we meet him, and we find out that the Croton prince is going to be married in Ossia, and as part of his marriage, he's going to receive the Ember Blade, which is this almost mythical weapon that was the symbol of all Ossian glory, but was stolen when the Crotons invaded. And it's like this massive slap in the face that the Croton prince is just going to get this thing, and it's going to kind of be a symbol of how Ossia is now completely subjugated. Now, Aaron doesn't care, because he's all for the Crotons, but for some strange reason, his father, who is supposed to be loyal to the Crotons, his father seems a bit dismayed by this news. And the fact that his father is disturbed by it disturbs Aaron, because now he's wondering, have I not seen all of my father's true nature? Is he hiding something from me? And this is a dramatic question that carries us on into the next chapter. So in chapter 8, which is the final chapter I'm going to analyze within the first 48 pages of The Ember Blade, Aaron visits his father in his study. His father is deep in thought, and when Aaron comes in, his father starts and almost attacks him with a knife, thinking that he is an assassin come to kill him. And Aaron is very disturbed by this. They kind of talk a bit about the Ember Blade. Aaron is realizing there's secrets to his father that he hasn't seen before. And pretty simply, it ends with Aaron realizing that maybe his father is not as loyal to Crota as he pretended to be. So the dramatic question to end this is, what secrets are lying in Aaron's father's past? Is his father secretly disloyal? Crotons. So now that I've given you the context of those first 48 pages, let's look at this in the macro. What is it that makes these opening 8 chapters so successful at hooking readers and pulling people into the rest of the book and making them feel invested in the characters? Well, that's where it's got to start. What makes this so successful to begin with is that it takes time to build the relationship between Cade and Aaron. And by having these kind of two characters as the main characters in the book, it allows these opening chapters to sort of do double duty in a sense, because not only do you get to characterize the relationship between these two, but the relationship between the two characters actually characterizes Aaron and Cade in and of themselves. So we get sympathy for them both, we get to understand, and there is some setup of natural tension and possible sources of conflict between them both. And we get subtle world building and this kind of organic development of the world through their interaction with each other, through their dialogue and what they're discussing and how they argue with each other. This next point is something that I have personally struggled with my writing and has taken me a while to identify and try to fix. And what the Ember Blade does, which is the opposite to how I have approached it in some of my stories in the past, is that it doesn't jump right into the conflict straight away. It has a slightly more circuitous route to get there. So what the Ember Blade has really taught me is that you can have smaller level conflict to begin your story with without worrying that you're going to lose readers because you're not getting to the main event. If you have small conflict that feels still important to the characters and is interesting and is fleshing out the world, then that's okay for the first, you know, 50, 100 pages of your book, as long as it's building to something, and as long as it's showing that you as the author have the capability to deliver that bigger story. If you can deliver this kind of smaller opening arcs, then readers are going to trust you for the rest of the book. And then the last big macro element is that it's interweaving a bunch of stuff. So it's not just a case of saying that this is the chapter about Aaron, this is the chapter about Cade, this is the chapter about Crotons, this is the chapter about the Ember Blade. It's not like that at all. All of these things are mixed together. And it's through mixing things together that you as an author get to hide the seams. Because if you are too obvious with how you are doling out information, and if you're too precise with how the story is structured and sort of laid out, then it might be obvious to readers that it has been structured and laid out. But if you kind of can mix everything together in this soup, it allows you to blend and interweave your story in a way that hides your marks, it hides the seams in your story. So by blending things together, you get this cohesion and this natural feeling to the story, which makes it feel much more interesting to read. So on a more micro level, if we drill into what makes each individual chapter successful, we can see that each chapter makes readers ask at least one, sometimes more, dramatic questions. So, like I mentioned, a dramatic question is just simply something that readers want to know about how the plot or a character will unfold in your story. I'm sure there are probably better definitions than that, but that's the one I'm going to go with for now. So, why are questions important? Well, I just did one then, it probably made you curious, right? And that is exactly what questions should do in your story. They should make readers want to keep reading. They should make readers curious about what's going to happen. The second key micro technique that is done and executed really well in the opening of the Ember Blade is that you feel sympathetic for the characters by the end of it. Both Aaron and Cade feel developed and realistic and three-dimensional, but they also have really strong goals, and they also have a good mix of characteristics which makes them sympathetic. So I've talked before about Brandon Sanderson's sliders, which is this idea that characters can be measured in terms of three different values. The first value is how proactive they are, the second value is how competent they are, and the third value is how likable they are. So if you have a character that is really good in all three of those categories, you get what's called the Superman problem, which is someone who is just godlike and perfectly good and not very interesting to read about because they don't have flaws. If you have a character that just has one out of three or two out of three of those traits, they're more interesting and relatable because they have flaws and they feel more human. So Aaron, for instance, is highly proactive, not that competent, and fairly likable. So we can see there, two out of three of those sliders, pretty interesting character. Cade, on the other hand, not very proactive at all, not very competent at all, but he's highly likable because he's very loyal. And that's enough for readers to root for him and be interested in seeing where he goes. The third key micro element within these opening chapters is that it establishes the tone. So getting the tone and the emotion of your story right in the opening is so important, because if you have one type of tone created in the beginning of your story, let's say a really farcical, comical tone, that's what your first 50 pages are about, and then the rest of your story is something completely different, like a dark horror thing, it's going to create a lot of confusion and tonal whiplash within readers, which will make the readers who came for one specific emotional experience be dismayed because you're delivering them a different emotional experience to the one you promised. And then the fourth and final micro element is that it is creating thematic foreshadowing. So as I have harped on about many times before, I think theme is probably the most important thing about your story. It's the moral question or argument that you are exploring within your narrative. So an example of a very simplistic theme that I often use is money is the root of all evil. What that means is that you will have characters on either side of that debate. You might have a character who says, no, money's actually really good. You can use it to solve poverty. And then another person is like, well, you know, like money is the root of all evil. The desire for money is what has created poverty in the first place, for example. So we see a lot of good thematic foreshadowing in these opening chapters. We see this idea very clearly established that to create a situation of victory, you require sacrifice, which is mentioned in that castles chapter. We also see this idea that the loyalty and friendship between Cade and Aaron is going to be sort of the heart and core of the story driving us forward. And we see a bunch of other stuff set up as well, such as the rivalry between Crotons and Ossians. So to wrap up this episode, by the end of your first 50 pages, readers shouldn't necessarily know what is going to happen in the rest of your story. But they should kind of know what to expect in terms of emotion. So the first 50 pages are really just about creating emotional expectations in your audience. And then making sure that readers are eager and really, really excited and curious to see how their expectations are met in the rest of your story. Thank you so much for listening or watching this episode of the Novel Analyst Podcast. I've been Jed Hearn, and I will see you next time. Now go and write extraordinary stories.